This is East End Inc. Tonight we present author David Margalek talking about The Promise and the Dream, the untold story of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy. David Margalek spoke at Canyon's Books in Sag Harbor in July 2018.
I thought that I would read just a little bit, just for starters. I have honed this down as much as I can, just a little bit from the introduction to the book, just to give you a little bit of an idea of some of the themes that I was exploring. Back they went to room 306 of the Lorraine Motel. Could the grieving disciples of Martin Luther King Jr. have possibly chosen a grimmer spot to reconvene, the spot where he'd been murdered only a few hours earlier, where his blood still stained the cement on the balcony outside? And yet, when they left the hospital in Memphis where King had died on the evening of April 4, 1968, what better place was there to mourn him than where he'd spent much of his last day on earth? Gathered there with King's personal effects nearby, Ralph Abernathy, Andrew Young, and the others grappled with the catastrophe that had just befallen them. What would now happen to their movement? Who could take King's place? And how could they help stop the rioting that had broken out in ghettos across America? But the same 19-inch Philco Starlight television set that beamed scenes of America aflame that night also brought some consolation from Indianapolis, where Senator Robert F. Kennedy had spoken shortly after King had been declared dead. Huddled against the cold in his big brother's old overcoat, he told a stunned and edgy crowd in the city's most dangerous neighborhood that King had just been killed, then pleaded for calm and brotherhood, reminding everyone, as if anyone could not have known, that someone he'd loved had also been killed, and also by a white man. And unlike so many of the other cities that night, Indianapolis had stayed calm. "We'd wanted to get on television and tell people not to fight, not to burn down the cities," recalled Andrew Young. "We were trying to get the message out to people. This is not what Dr. King would have you doing. But the press didn't want to talk to us. We were saying, look, Dr. King is gone. The important thing now is for us to keep his work going, and people are out in the streets now doing things that he wouldn't want them to do. They weren't interested in that. Bobby Kennedy's was the only voice we identified with that night. We were grateful he was out there." He almost hadn't been. Kennedy's most senior advisors had urged him to cancel the event. Doing anything political on such a night would look bad, and going into the ghetto was just too dangerous. So had the mayor of Indianapolis, Richard Lugar, who'd never set foot around 17th and Broadway, where a couple thousand people, nearly all of them black, had already gathered. So had the Indianapolis police. So had the customarily fearless Ethel Kennedy, who'd gone back to the hotel, praying in the back seat every minute en route. Even Kennedy might have had second thoughts. While his relationship with King had slowly improved from contentious to careful to respectful over the 8 years they'd known each other, and their causes had come increasingly to overlap, the two men had never been close. The racial and cultural divide between them had simply been too broad. They'd become allies, but never had they been friends. Why would Kennedy, of all people, subject himself to such a risk? And yet, improbably, Bobby Kennedy, a near total stranger to black America only 10 years earlier, felt more at home in it now than any other white politician in America. When, shortly after he'd landed in Indianapolis, police officials reiterated their warning, he'd brushed it aside. "My family and I could lay down in the street there and they wouldn't bother me," he told them. That everyone else urged him to stay away was, for him, only another reason to go. At first, for both John and Robert Kennedy, King meant trouble, a distraction from the things they'd really come to Washington to do. Every big demonstration or turmoil that Martin King led was a problem for the president, Robert Kennedy's key deputy at the Justice Department, Burke Marshall, later said. But as Attorney General, Robert Kennedy was usually King's point of contact. That meant 3 years of tense telephone standoffs, telegrammed pleas for protection, stiff, formal typewritten complaints, and occasionally compliments. At the same time, it was Robert Kennedy who had helped spring King from jail in Georgia, saved his life, or so he thought, when King huddled in the basement as an angry mob besieged a Montgomery, Alabama church, pleaded with him to halt the freedom rides, and when King refused to drop two aides with past communist ties, directed that his telephone be tapped. Theirs was an uneven relationship, and for King, a slightly degrading one. He was the black man invariably asking for things, and Kennedy the white man doling them out, but only when his brother's political interests permitted. King was the one to say please and thank you. King was not without his powers. He'd arguably gotten John Kennedy elected, and he was the custodian of a large chunk of his legacy. And while he hectored, lectured, criticized, and exasperated Robert Kennedy, he'd also helped educate him. When they'd met, Kennedy had little experience with or interest or understanding of or empathy for blacks. King helped coax out Bobby Kennedy's better angels. King approached Bobby Kennedy with a hard-headedness that the pragmatic Kennedy would have admired. He had no illusions about Kennedy's instincts, which were viewed initially by the skeptical civil rights community as authoritarian, pragmatic, and not especially sympathetic. But it was Robert Kennedy with whom he knew he'd have to deal, and he'd ordered his colleagues, most notably Harry Belafonte, to go find Kennedy's moral center and not return until they had. Following President Kennedy's assassination, much changed between the two. As a United States Senator, Kennedy no longer lorded over King and had fewer plums to dispense, and King had fewer favors to ask. So over the last 4 years of their truncated lives, they barely saw each other. No longer compelled to deal with each other, they didn't. Their preoccupations and goals, ending the war in Vietnam, tackling racial discrimination in the United States, South Africa, and elsewhere, fighting poverty, increasingly overlapped. And yet, Kennedy took care not to cozy up to King, who by now was the more radical later Martin Luther King, rather than the avuncular Martin Luther King of the March on Washington and eventually the national holiday. It might not have posed a problem in New York, but would have done him no good among white voters nationally. King's views on Vietnam were far too extreme for Kennedy to embrace, as was his larger critique of American foreign policy and culture. Wary is the word most frequently invoked to describe them. But still, the prospect of a Kennedy-King alliance, one that was emerging as Kennedy assembled his electoral coalition in his final campaign, was, Harry Belafonte theorized, the right wing's greatest fear until Memphis on April 4, 1968. "What do I say?" Kennedy had asked his press secretary, Frank Mankiewicz, on the flight into Indianapolis that night. Should he use what his speechwriters had hastily prepared for him, or go with his gut? In fact, as was often true when Kennedy asked such questions, he already had his answer. Standing on the back of a flatbed truck at 17th and Broadway, he spoke for 7 minutes. What he said that night elicited little commentary afterwards. It came too late for the morning papers, and like King's equally memorable remarks the night before, his last speech, the one about having been to the mountaintop, it was lost in the enormity of the assassination. But in room 306 of the Lorraine Motel, Kennedy's words were duly noted. He was in the middle of a totally black community, and he stood there without fear and with great confidence and empathy, and he literally poured his soul out talking about his brother, Young later recalled. The amazing thing to us was that the crowd listened. He reached them. Kennedy could never replace King, but to his disciples back at the Lorraine Motel and throughout the black community, he had picked up his torch. In him, everyone in that room at that grim moment seemed to agree, resided pretty much all of whatever hope remained. There was but one question about that torch: how long Bobby Kennedy would get to hold it. "I don't know. I almost feel like," somebody said, "he's probably going to be next," Young later recalled. "I can't remember that, but that was the feeling that many of us had." So that's the way that the book begins, and it's an instructive moment for me. I had a couple of serious challenges in doing this book. The first one was that the man who brought this book to me, the opportunity to do this book, didn't give me much time to do it. I had about 6 months to write this book. I mean, you know, like any good writer, I extended it to eight months. You know, I think I only missed a couple of deadlines on this. But it had to be done quickly because the anniversaries were coming up. This book was coming out. It was pegged to the 250th anniversaries in April and June of this year. So it had to be done fast. That was the first challenge. Second challenge really was to write something original. There's a huge record on these two guys, you know. How do you say something new about them? That was the second challenge. And the third challenge, which is sort of paradoxically the opposite of the second challenge, was there enough to write a book about them? All right. This problem came up in one of my early interviews. Shortly after I agreed to do the book, I talked to Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, the eldest Robert Kennedy daughter, and as it ended up, the only one of Kennedy's kids that I spoke with. And she was quite adamant about this project. She said, "You don't have a book here," which is a little bit discouraging to hear. But anyway, she said, "You don't have a book here." She said, "You know, the fact that these two guys ran into one another a couple of times and had a few phone calls and everything, they really didn't know each other. And there's not a book. You don't have enough. You know, my advice to you is just to drop the project now." That was a sobering moment. But the reason that the opening scene is significant to me is that certainly in the public mind, this moment in Indianapolis is what ties these two guys together very profoundly. Who can help but associate the two of them based on Kennedy's speech in Indianapolis that night? It turns out that it was really the only time when Kennedy ever spoke about Martin Luther King publicly. If you go from the 1960 presidential election and the role that Robert Kennedy played there, and the whole story about when King was incarcerated and how the Kennedys got him out of jail, and you jump from that to the fact that Robert Kennedy was the one that signed the authorization of the wiretap that was placed on King's phones at home and at his office. And then you jump from that to Indianapolis, and you have these three different junctures. Well, you know there's a book here. If you're describing how his relationship evolved and changed, and how the same man that bugged Martin Luther King ended up giving the most memorable eulogy for Martin Luther King, more memorable than anything that anybody said at King's own funeral, you know there's a book here, all right? And with all due respect to Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, the fact that there's not a huge documentary record, well, that just presents a different challenge to the writer. That means that you have to look in different places. You have to look in the shadows. Sometimes journalists or historians have to explain the absence of something, all right? Because absences are not accidental. I mean, why, for instance, is it this book was originally going to be a picture book? I mean, that's one of the reasons that originally I was given so short a time to write it. It was originally going to be done by the National Geographic, and it was going to be mostly pictures. And as I've described it, I was sort of brought in to do the grouting, you know? I mean, I was going to write the copy that was going to go around the pictures. 40,000 words worth of grouting. Anyway, I ended up writing 110,000 words, and the Geographic didn't like that, and they pulled the plug on the book. You'll see that it says Rosetta Books here and not National Geographic on the spine of the book. That's no accident. Although there are still lots of pictures, it still bears its lineage because there are lots and lots of wonderful pictures in the book.
This is East End Inc. on WPKN Radio. We're listening to author David Margalek talking about his book, The Promise and the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy.
But you won't see in the book a single picture of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King together. Alone together, okay? You'll see group pictures, you know, pictures at the White House with Roy Wilkins is also in the picture, and Whitney Young is in the picture, and LBJ is in the picture. But you won't see a picture of the two of them together sitting and talking intently to one another, feeling comfortable, looking comfortable with one another. Why is that? I mean, that's no accident, all right? Now, it's clearly not because King would never have objected to it. As I said in what I just read, King was sort of the supplicant. King would have welcomed audiences with Robert Kennedy. But Robert Kennedy was keeping his distance. Robert Kennedy was a pragmatic politician. It's incredible to think now, but the Kennedys were afraid of losing Southern support. I mean, can you imagine Democrats worried about the South, you know? But the South was still in play. They were worried about Georgia in the 1964 election, you know? Hanging around with King too closely, well, this is not the kind of thing that they wanted to do. King never got invited to Hickory Hill. Harry Belafonte and Michael Schneerson wrote Harry Belafonte's book, Michael, my dear friend back there. Harry Belafonte got invited to Hickory Hill often, you know? Even James Baldwin got invited to Hickory Hill, but King never did. So Kennedy kept his distance, and that's the reason why there are no pictures of the two of them together. And even, I mean, one of the things that really strikes me is that the night that Kennedy gave the speech in Indianapolis. After that, the presidential primaries that were the campaigning in the presidential primaries was suspended for several days, pending Martin Luther King's funeral in Atlanta. And Bobby Kennedy gave only one more speech before he gave a speech the next morning in Cleveland before he suspended his campaigning to go to the funeral. And in that speech, this was considered one of his great speeches. He decried American violence and, you know, the culture of violence that had overtaken the country, you know, as illustrated by the assassination the night before. But there's one problem with the speech, which is he never mentions Martin Luther King by name. How can you speak about violence the night after Martin Luther King was assassinated and not mention Martin Luther King? And I would suggest that that's not an accident. He was already sort of distancing himself from Martin Luther King. And yet, he's a wonderfully complicated character. And he arranged to have King's body flown back to Atlanta. He brought Coretta King up to Memphis to fly it back. He was the one that arranged the plane. Lyndon Johnson didn't, the President of the United States didn't. It was Robert Kennedy sort of acting as a president in waiting who was the one that did it. And that's one of the great things about the speech is the complexity of the man. So my challenge was to find where the evidence was. I won't say there's a lot of stuff that was really newly declassified. There's a lot of stuff about King that's recently been declassified, and great revelations to come about that still, and interesting revelations and revelations that will cause people great discomfort in all of this. That's not really true for Robert Kennedy, but nobody had ever, I guess maybe because the challenge of writing about these two guys was there, nobody had ever really looked at all the existing documentation to try to see what was in there about their relationship. And that was part of the challenge that I had. And so what do you do? Well, one of the things that you do is that you speak to, I mean, the most important thing that you can do really is to speak to the people who knew them. I mean, this is what we do as journalists and as historians. We do triage. We get to people before they die. You know, that's what it comes down to. It's a rescue mission. It's a rescue mission, and it's important work. It's sacred work, really. You know, that conversation that I said, sounding like a journalist, you know, Young later recalled. Well, he recalled that to me. You know, I called Andrew Young. He was gracious enough to take my calls more than once. And he told, you know, he was the one that told me about going back into the hotel, the Lorraine Motel. You know, imagine sitting in Martin Luther King's room. There's a picture in the book of the custodian at the Lorraine Motel mopping up the blood on the balcony that night in the dark. And these guys are sitting in the room talking about, you know, what are we going to do now? And he had other stories to tell about Kennedy going down to King's funeral and going up to Daddy King's hotel room. And Daddy King is in bed wearing his pajamas, and Bobby Kennedy talking to Daddy King and comparing notes about their losses. And, you know, these are just amazing stories. And again, you know, you would think Andrew Young has written his memoirs. All right, so surely these things are in his memoirs. You know, like the line about go out and find King's moral center, that's in the book that Michael wrote. You know, I mean, I'm indebted to Michael for that story, okay? There's an instance where the story is already out there and, you know, you're sort of, you know, you're rounding up the evidence that's already public. But these stories about going back to the Lorraine Motel that night, Andrew Young had never told them before. Why? Because, you know, he's written his memoir, but he has a lot of memories. He can't put them, you know, he can't fit them all in his book. He didn't fit them all in his book. And so when I talked to him, you know, I mean, you're sort of in awe when you hear this stuff. And I said to him at the end of the conversation, you know, in so many words, gee whiz, you know, thank you for talking to me. You know, thank you for sharing all of this stuff with me. And he said, no, thank you. Why? He said, listen, I got all these stories. I'm not going to get them out. I'm never going to, you know, if people don't ask me these stories, I'm never going to get the chance to tell them. You know, he had an accident after I spoke to him. I'm told he's now in a wheelchair. You know, I haven't spoken to him since, but, you know, I mean, as I say, it's a rescue mission. And that, you know, that applied to John Lewis. I talked to him too, not at such length, but to Harry Belafonte. Again, thanks to Michael, you know, I got to talk to Harry Belafonte. And then there are people in King's circle as well. You know, Marion Wright Edelman, Peter Edelman, Adam Walensky, you know, Kennedy's speech writers. You know, these guys are all in their 70s and 80s now. You know, they're the ones, it's like one-stop shopping to talk to these people, and there are no sources like them. I mean, there's a lot of revisionism, as you all know, that seeps into history. And I remember that, one instance of it is the famous question of why Bobby Kennedy approved the wiretaps on King, all right? And one school of thought, I think it was purveyed by, among other people, Arthur Schlesinger, right after, you know, when Arthur Schlesinger worked for the Kennedys, you know, and here he is writing the history, and his history is one of the basic texts of the Kennedys. And he said, well, it was really because Kennedy was concerned about King and he wanted to protect him. And that's why he wiretapped him, you know, that, you know, he wanted to clear all these stories about how King was really a communist, and Hoover was gonna out him as a communist. And Kennedy wanted to establish once and for all that King was not a communist. And if he wiretapped him for a while and there was nothing about anything communist on the tapes, that would vindicate him, and it would clear King's name. That's why he did it. And that's the school of thought that's out there, and it comes from, you know, the eminent historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr., okay? But I had the luxury of calling Martin Luther King's lawyer, Clarence Jones, all right? Again, somebody who's been under-interviewed. I ran that theory past him, and he said, that's absolutely not true. He said, you know, Kennedy was a politician. What was Kennedy thinking about? He was thinking about the Kennedys, all right? What served the Kennedys? You know, they had to be careful about King. They had to make sure that King wasn't going to embarrass them. They were intertwined with King. They were dependent on King. King was their interlocutor to the black community. But they had to sort of be prepared and know what was going on with him and who he was hanging out with and all of that. And that's why he approved the wiretap. He was the one alone among the people in the Kennedy administration who was urging his brother to introduce civil rights legislation. And he was the one that was really responsible for the incredible speech that I remember from when I was 12 years old or whatever I was, 11 years old, when John Kennedy got on television and said that this country has a debt to pay and a problem to solve for the first time, and called for the passage of civil rights legislation. There's an old interview with Robert Kennedy. The Kennedys are great at recording their own histories, all right? I mean, it's quite astonishing that within weeks of John Kennedy's death, the Kennedy Library was already being set up and everybody was giving oral interviews and they were creating Camelot already, you know, within the space of just a few weeks. And the person who interviewed Robert Kennedy for Robert Kennedy's interview for the Kennedy Library was Anthony Lewis of the New York Times. And Anthony Lewis, you know, again, one of my former colleagues, an eminent reporter, but really Kennedy's personal reporter in a way, all right? I mean, you read a story in the Times by Anthony Lewis about a source close to Robert Kennedy said such and so, you know it's Robert Kennedy. You know, you just know it. And in that interview, you know, Kennedy talks about approving the wiretap as if it was like going to lunch. He said, yeah, and then we agreed to put a wiretap on him and blah, 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 blah. No, absolutely no agonizing at all, all right? So the chance to talk in a few years, you know, it'll be too late to talk to these guys. And that's one of the things that I did. There are two complicated guys. The story lies in the interstices. There are a lot of interstices in here, 110,000 words worth of them.
This is East End Inc. We heard David Margalek talking about his book, The Promise and the Dream, the untold story of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy. The book contains photos by Douglas Brinkley. It was published in 2018 by Rosato Press. David Margalek is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair and the author of Elizabeth and Hazel, The Women of Little Rock, and Strange Fruit, the biography of a song. Some free literary events at Canyon's Cultural Cafe, 290 Main Street, Sag Harbor, include biographer Mary Gabriel, author of Ninth Street Women, in conversation with Ellen Harrison, art historian and director of the Pollock Krasner House, on Saturday, November 17th at 4 p.m. Essayist, memoirist, and radio host David Bouchier speaks on the serious side of humor writing on Saturday, December 8th at 4 p.m. And fiction writer Simon Van Bui reads from his new story collection, The Sadness of Beautiful Things, on Saturday, December 15th at 5 p.m. More events are listed at caniosbooks.com. East End Inc. programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Catherine Zoka and Marianne Calendro. This is Hazel Kahn.